This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show with me, T. Xiao Yik. We know that violence, neglect and trauma harms a child, but we actually know very little about the lifelong effects of such harm. Professor Michael Dunn, a professor of social epidemiology from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, is here to share research that is now showing the long-term impact of childhood adversity on physical health as well as mental disorders well into adulthood. Good afternoon, Professor Michael. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Professor Michael, we can't turn anywhere today without reading about horrific issues affecting children. Now we have a term to describe these issues, adverse childhood experiences. What does this term mean and how did it come about?
Adverse childhood experiences is really it's a group of problems that children commonly experience. Of course, there's 1,000 terrible things that can happen in the lives of people, and especially in childhood. All of them are sensitive. But some of them are more common than others and some of them are more harmful. And over the past 2 decades, there's been realisation that while a lot of the focus is on child abuse, say physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse and neglect, and everybody's familiar with them, there are a broader cluster of conditions which also seriously can damage children. For example, being exposed to domestic violence in the household, parental divorce and separation, where that's particularly difficult or traumatic. Growing up in a family where someone has a mental illness or someone is imprisoned. Growing up in a dangerous neighbourhood, being exposed to bullying in schools or in the environment, witnessing civil conflict. There's really about 23 different types of exposures which are known to have the most serious effects.
The term really, I think, originated from the study that was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, in the US, and Kaiser Permanente, which is a healthcare provider group. Yeah. Can you tell us more about that study, which seems to be groundbreaking in laying out this new understanding?
Yes. Yes, that study is groundbreaking, and it really, for the first time, said that we'll investigate the accumulated adversity in childhood along the same dimensions that I talked about before. And what they did was interviewed 17,300 adults who were in this health insurance group, for which there was excellent data about their physical diseases, their healthcare costs, their medication use. In between 1995 and 97, they interviewed these adults about what happened in their childhood. And now they've been followed for more than 20 years. And so you can look at the clinically verified and measurable health effects. What it's revealing, and it's slowly being revealed over time, is just how pernicious the effects are. That people who are exposed to multiple adversities, so they have 4 or 5 or 6 or more adverse conditions, then they are much more likely to develop chronic diseases, much more likely to be hospitalised and also to die early compared to people who went through their childhood with, limited exposure to adverse conditions. I should say that studies done in every country, including what we find in East Asia, is that everyone is exposed to some form of adversity. We're not saying that children should skip through their childhood and experience nothing difficult. Of course everybody does. The real issue is that when you have multiple adversities that co-occur, so it can be living in a family where someone has a serious mental illness, where there's economic uncertainty and deprivation, where there's maybe food insecurity, and where the child might be a victim of physical violence in their neighbourhood. When you put them together, there are long-term effects.
But these factors are associated. I mean, how do we know that we can say they cause or they lead to the chronic diseases in adulthood?
Well, if we're looking at that Kaiser Permanente study, as well as a lot of other research that's been done, when you look at people who had multiple exposures in childhood and then look to see what happened to them. So people with multiple exposures were more likely to go to hospital for COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a serious respiratory condition. Not only are they more likely to go to hospital, but the more there's a linear relationship. So the more adversity they have as a child, they are more they go to hospital earlier.
Mm.
And the differences are are remarkable. Mm. For people with no adversities or only one, comparing to them, those with five or more go to hospital with COPD 17 years earlier.
Oh.
So the difference is between, say, 73 versus 56.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable.
Yes.
It's extraordinary. And these are not, this isn't self-report. It's not, you know, bias or something, you know, reporting bias. It's these people are in hospital with COPD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's many years after they had talked about their childhood.
But in getting the information about the childhood experiences that they went through, how do we avoid the bias there? How do we know that people are recollecting accurately?
Well, it's a very good question. And we know that there's error in people's memories. You know, no one has a perfect memory. And yes, there's questions about the recall accuracy. Whether there's a bias is another matter, because a bias is saying that there's a systematic error, which means that, you know, you're saying that the health condition, whether it's a depression or whether it's a respiratory condition, is somehow related to inaccurate recall. But everyone, you know, no one has a perfect memory. Everyone has error in their memory. And there's not convincing evidence that the health condition itself is linked with inaccurate recall. So it's not a bias.
Mm-hmm. Now, based on all the other research that has come out since the Kaiser Permanente study,
mm-hmm.
What do we know about how prevalent, how common multiple adverse childhood experiences are? And what are the trends that we're seeing across the years? Okay.
We've done a lot of work in East Asia, including in Malaysia some years ago. In schools, we did the first randomised study. This is with my colleagues at University of Malaya, where this was specifically on child maltreatment. We've also done a lot of work in Vietnam and in China and in Indonesia and in countries like Solomon Islands. What we find is that about one in every six or seven children in all populations will have four or more of these adverse experiences.
Mm.
There's a 16 to 20% of children in most populations. Of course, countries vary, but the median would be around, you know, one in every six or seven children are exposed to this multiple adversity. And there's many others, of course, who are exposed to, you know, three difficult circumstances, and they also are associated with poor health. So we know that the types of specific events that happen, the specific exposures, are very different.
Mm-hmm.
In some countries, for example, throughout Africa, there's been a lot of exposure to civil conflict.
Of course.
And, you know, and community crime and so on, whereas in some other countries it's much less. We know we've carefully looked at the exposure of children to sexual abuse in Chinese societies. And we've done that for many years, and we're able to show that exposure to sexual abuse in Chinese societies is much less than in Western societies and African societies. It's probably half, or even less than half. So the things that, and the types of physical violence that's perpetrated against children varies by culture as well,
mm-hmm.
Including in Asia. So that in Thailand, children are much less likely to be exposed to severe physical punishment than they are, for example, in China, where it's practiced much more commonly.
Mm.
So there's no... Yes, cultures vary.
Mm.
That's absolutely clear.
Yeah. Are there cultural differences in the way that childhood violence is addressed or spoken of within society?
Well, absolutely. There are significant cultural differences in the norms for, say, physical violence against children. We know that, you know, in some countries it's entirely illegal, and it's quite rare that the children will be physically beaten by their parents as part of discipline. Other societies, it's regarded as an effective mode of parenting.
Mm.
I remember in the launch of the Global Report into Violence Against Children in the United Nations, I happened to be there at the time, and there was a strong discussion amongst the countries about whether parents and teachers had the right and whether society had the right to physically punish people.
Where the spanking is considered
abuse. Absolutely. Yeah. And the representative from Singapore stood up and was strident in saying that there's definitely a right for parents to beat their children and it's written into law. So, and there are other, and the representative from Singapore wasn't alone in that. There are other people who were pushing back against it and saying that it isn't the place of the law, it isn't the place of international organisations to tell parents what they should do.
I mean, in Malaysia, spanking is very much part and parcel of growing up for many of us. So there is a lot of pushback to change that kind of mindset. That any form of physical harm, there's a very thin line that crosses into abuse.
Yes. There's several perspectives on that. One of the benefits from changing behaviour, from changing the norms, from making any hitting of children less acceptable, there's a clear goals around the world to do that. It helps to overcome the problem of unintentional escalation, where children can be spanked and the parent may escalate to a point where that goes far beyond what the parent intended.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's physical harm to the child, and particularly psychological harm to that child.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's very difficult to contain. Another perspective, of course, is to say that if parents don't have physical hitting and stern emotional control in their toolbox, then what else can they do?
What else can they do?
Well, of course, it's that's the challenge, and a lot of parents would say it's fine for them. They do this out of love, and they would do it sparingly, but they would only physically hit a child if it was for the child's safety.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of calling that. And countries do vary, cultures vary. And a lot of people, on a positive side, certainly in the last 5 years, have been, particularly in Chinese societies, have been strident in promoting the benefits of, say, being a tiger mum. Sure. There's books have been written about that. And there's some serious discussion about we're not talking about physical beating, but in terms of tight emotional control and control over movements of children and the continued focus on, academic achievement and so on, whether that's harmful or not. And a lot of people say it's not.
Well, this is all actually really interesting because these are the cultural norms that we live with.
Mm-hmm.
And with the research that you are involved in, we now know that, it very quickly crosses into that area where it becomes harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what we are talking about today is that these kinds of adverse experiences in childhood have long-term effects well into adulthood that's now only really being documented.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go for a quick break. I've been speaking to Professor Michael Dunn from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia about the impact of adverse childhood experiences on physical and mental health over the long term. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Shao Ik. I'm with Professor Michael Dunn, a professor of social epidemiology from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, who is here to share research showing the long-term impact of adverse childhood experiences on physical and mental health that occur in adulthood. Before the break, Professor Michael, you explained these sort of clusters of adverse childhood experiences that tend to co-occur in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And some examples of these are domestic violence. Of course, apart from abuse and harm actually being inflicted on a child, it could also be things that they experience in their environment. So this could be things like domestic violence, divorce among their parents, somebody in a family living with a severe mental illness. So how do these kinds of adverse childhood experiences correspond with physical and mental health in adulthood. I'd really like to know more about that link now.
Last year, we, with a group in the UK, we drew together the best evidence from the 37 best studies in the world, and they're really good quality studies, that, that linked multiple adverse experiences in childhood with physical diseases and also mental disorders. It's very clear that there's clusters. Now, first of all, some of the discussion around ACEs, or adversity, is that everything is associated with it, and it's just all diseases and all conditions are caused by adversity. Well, they're not. We're able to identify clusters of conditions that are not really associated with multiple adversity. Interestingly, diabetes, low levels of physical activity, and overweight and obesity seem not to be associated with multiple adversity. There's a group of physical conditions that have moderate association, so cardiovascular disease, hypertension, liver disease, including liver cirrhosis and liver cancer, and also a range of respiratory diseases, and also the likelihood that someone as an adult persists with smoking. Not experiments when they're younger, but whether their cigarette smoking persists through adulthood. And also heavy drinking. So there's a moderate cluster that are meaningfully related as well.
Mm-hmm.
So the drinking and liver disease and the smoking and respiratory disease.
And cardiovascular, of course.
Yeah, that's right, cardiovascular, yes. Beyond that, when we look at the conditions that are very strongly associated, and there's statistical terms for this, but where we see more than tripling the risk, between triple to seven times the risk, when I say strongly associated, and you see that severe depression, anxiety disorders, alcohol dependence disorder, substance abuse disorder, are associated with early exposure to childhood. So this is, we're talking about evidence that comes from the populations across the world where adults, the health of adults was checked when they're in their 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, and they were also asked about their childhood experiences independently.
Mm.
You know, they weren't asked, oh, you've got depression, now tell me about your childhood. Mm. It's not like that.
Yeah.
So we have more than seven times the risk is a smaller cluster with the most severe conditions. Importantly, the risk of being a perpetrator of violence, and especially amongst males, for males who perpetrate violence, many of those males were also victims of adversity as a child. Now, that doesn't excuse violence,
mm-hmm.
but it does help to explain why some adult males are more prone to violence, because it actually is a continuation, there's a cycle of violence. The vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a part of how people discuss violence, of course, but the evidence is clear.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the most troubling is that the risk of being re-victimised, the risk of a woman or a man being a victim of violence in their adult years, is strongly associated with what happened to them as a child. Mm. Also troubling is the highest risk is for suicide. Suicidal actions and thoughts, persistent thoughts, are very strongly linked with childhood adversity.
Mm.
And this includes studies of adults in their 60s and 70s where suicide risk is high.
We would have assumed that suicidal thoughts would have occurred at a time close to the abuse taking place. But are you talking about suicide and ideation and attempts many, many decades later?
Yes, mm. yeah. Suicidal thinking is, for some people, it's persistent for a long period and it's a big feature of their life, but that's only a small number. The majority of people will have occasional thoughts about that. The great majority of people, when asked, will say yes, they've somehow thought about that at some point. But what we focus on is people who've had persistent thoughts over the past year. So it's usually that they have periods of several weeks where they are thinking very gloomily about their life and thinking about taking their own life. Although not all suicidal acts, of course, are related with depression. Most of them are, but some are associated with other conditions. What's absolutely seems to be the case is that while suicide and depression have a genetic component to it, we've published work some years ago on that, but probably the biggest single cause for depressive disorder is your inheritance, that essentially it's influenced by genes. The clusters of genes are not fully understood, but it looks to be genetic. That would be the biggest factor. But the second strongest contributing factor, and certainly the strongest preventable factor, is child maltreatment and avoidable adversity in childhood.
So knowing what we know about that link, and you've said earlier that when children grow up with a family member who's living with a serious mental health condition, that counts as an adverse experience. And knowing what we know now that, you know, the cycle continues, how can we prevent or sort of break that chain from a child living with that in childhood to, you know, experiencing it themselves and then, passing it on to their children who are growing up around them?
Well, there's a specific and general issue of that. Like, if you're talking about growing up in a family with some of the mental illness, some people do that very well, and some children adapt strongly to that, positive adaptation. Where it's not perhaps the living with the person, you know, I'm not blaming, of course, shooting home blame on the person who's got a mental illness, on the mother or the father or the uncle or the grandparent who has a mental illness, but it's the impact is on the child. Is sometimes the children are forced by that condition to actually take over the role of the parent. And look after their siblings and you know, leave school and earn money and so on. And that's where the
adverse impact is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a solution to that specific scenario, or one approach, is to provide social support in the home. You know, definitely home-based care, home visiting for families at high risk. And there's a lot of evidence in Australia and the US and other countries that show that home-based nurse visiting is very effective for families at high risk, such as the case of a child growing up where a parent is drug dependent or has a mental illness. More broadly, the interventions at a social level that are effective in cutting the cycle of violence is to intervene in schools especially for bullying prevention. Mm. Now, bullying prevention is a very popular topic, and a lot of schools in Malaysia and many countries are doing good work in that. What's absolutely clear is that bullying for prevention works. Over a period of 25 years in multiple European countries, including in Eastern Europe, that previously had very high levels of bullying, that 25 years of effort has significantly reduced, so that across Europe, the risk of bullying declined by more than half. Now, that's a remarkable achievement. Mm. So, reducing bullying. What does that do? When you reduce bullying, it just doesn't disappear into a vacuum. What it does is it replaces, constructively, there's a culture of respect, of interpersonal respect, and an intolerance of bullying and other harms to children by peers or by adults. And so, what changes is the norms. And it is in many societies becoming less normative to bully others. Mm. Of course, there's all sorts of changes with technologies and so on. But overall, the picture is positive. The bullying is effective. There are another way that the societies seem to be responding. To reducing adversity in children is by better mental health care for adults. And it seems clear from global analyses that as the quality of mental health care and the quality of mental health medicines has improved and the reach into the community, that parents who are suffering from anxiety disorders and are prone to violent outbursts perhaps, and parents suffering depression, when that's treated well, their children are less likely to be exposed to violence and other adversity. So the improvement in mental health care across the society seems to have a long-term positive benefit.
Child marriage is a pretty controversial issue that we are tackling now in Malaysia. Does child marriage count as an adverse experience, even when the argument is that the marriage is to save the girl from poverty?
I would have to really, in that question, I'm not an expert in child marriage. I'd say that there's, and I know that there's been some excellent analysis of this in Malaysia recently. There's the, there was a report on child marriage that was commissioned by UNICEF, and National University of Malaysia has released a report on that. And it's easy to find that. Just Google child marriage in Malaysia and you'll find that report. It's absolutely comprehensive. It's a very impressive study where many young people are married, were interviewed, and where many legal cases were investigated. Hundreds and hundreds of different sources of evidence were gathered. And it shows, yes, that there are adversities associated with child marriage. And it's interesting at a time right now in Malaysia where there's been that people looking seriously about that and trying to prevent the harms in child marriage. Now, I'm sure that amongst people listening and many people in Malaysia and Indonesia, where child marriage is also quite popular, would say that their child marriage was perfectly successful and not harmful. Yes. Then that's acknowledged. But it also has to be acknowledged that for some child brides, but also that young men, are harmed by it, and there's reproductive health problems, there's pregnancy, much poorer pregnancy outcomes, there's risk of isolation because people become isolated from their peers. There could well be long-term physical health effects which are not really understood. But I think it's largely about the rights of young people to education and the rights of young people to autonomy.
And that's what child marriage deprives them of.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that is behind a lot of the advocacy against child marriage, or at least the much more careful control and to try and reduce the context, particularly where there's clear exploitation, sexual exploitation of young girls.
And we've covered like so many examples of conditions that are linked to adverse childhood experiences, and they range so widely. You've talked about low association or moderate association with cardiovascular disease, mm-hmm. and then you've talked about very, very strong association with alcoholism, mm-hmm. let's say. Is it possible to predict these outcomes in any individual?
No. what's called the positive predictive value. When you know a person's circumstances, you then can you predict what their outcome is for that individual? The answer is no.
But by looking at, say, certain risk-taking behaviours?
Well, just the number of adverse experiences themselves are not highly predictive at the individual level. Mm. You have to understand the moderating factors. And so many people in society have been exposed to a lot of adversity and end up having very successful and productive relationships and very, good lives, successful lives that are apparently unimpeded by this adversity. That's probably the majority of people exposed to adversity are resilient and cope and do well. Whether or not this cluster of adverse experience predicts poor outcomes depends upon whether that child has emotional support, whether, despite all the adversity, there is at least one person to whom that child can have a close relationship. Now, I want to sort of emphasise that because it's not only childhood adversity, it's the same for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, where as an adult people are exposed to some terrible things. It could be emergency services workers, police, exposed to absolutely dreadful things in the course of their job. What matters is whether that person has an outlet, has an emotional outlet, has someone that's close to them. If a child is suffering this adversity and they're suffering it in isolation, then that is going to be much more damaging than if they're not. There's also access to opportunity, access to education, access to community groups, whether that's a religious group or a social group. If they have access to a community group in their neighbourhood, in the school, then that matters. So it's what distinguishes someone with really poor outcomes from someone with, resilience is often whether or not they can have positive social connections.
And these kinds of support systems and networks and safety nets have to be in place during at that point, isn't it, when a child is going through these experiences?
Yes, yes. It's hard, as any psychotherapist or psychiatrist will say, that it's very difficult once the damage has been done, and if that damage has persisted for 5-10 years, to try to treat that damage is extremely difficult.
Okay. Yep. I'm with Professor Michael Dunn, a professor of social epidemiology from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, and we're talking about the impact of adverse childhood experiences on physical and mental health in adulthood. When we come back from the break, we will talk more about knowing what we know now about these childhood experiences, what can we do to improve resilience among these children. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show with me, T. Shao Eek. I'm with Professor Michael Dunn, a professor of social epidemiology from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, and we're looking at the long-term effects of childhood trauma. And earlier in the show, Professor Michael has comprehensively talked about the different types of adverse experiences that children are exposed to, which can increase their risk then of physical and mental health issues or problems well into adulthood. And of course, Professor Michael has also talked about the kind of emotional and social support that is really crucial for children to have if they are going through these experiences in order to sort of improve their resilience. And I was also wondering, Professor Michael, what are the kind of structures that need to be in place to ensure that children have access to these kinds of support?
The most successful structures are through the schools, and the great majority of children in most societies are at school. And so school support systems, are, you know, counselling services are very important. Where you have safe spaces for children and zero tolerance policies for violence are very important. Now, we're all familiar with those, with the efforts in schools. Another effective system that is in place in many societies is where teachers will be trained and then connected and offered lots of resources to connect the teachers with mental health services, so that the teacher and maybe a deputy principal who's specific training in this, the teacher will go to that person and that child and that family can be connected with the services. This is a safety net approach where there's serious risk of harm, where and that the child themselves may not have disclosed, you know, the difficulties that they're having, you know, having to raise their siblings and cook when they go home and so on like that and so on. But the teacher might have learned that from a friend of that child, or the teacher may have observed pattern of behaviour. Lateness and hunger and dirty clothes and so on. Those types of teachers being able to identify what's going on and then refer to the professionals is a very important social safety net. A lot, however, everything's changing in this in 2018, and the strategies that were effective in the 1990s and the early 2000s to provide emotional support and to try to ameliorate the adverse effects of these experiences really relied on services being provided in physical space.
Mm-hmm.
So safe spaces were set up in clinics and reproductive health clinics and mental health services and so on, that children encouraged to go to services. But now increasingly children live in a virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
As the effective system for that is through e-health or m-health, or mobile health, where there's so many options have been tried and developed and tried to provide advice and counselling and emotional support and solutions, you know, practical advice about, you know, how a child can remove themselves from difficult circumstances, what a child should do if they're physically beaten or sexually abused and so on. That around the world there have been a lot of efforts in this e-health and m-health. Some of them are successful, many are not.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Many of these platforms are not successful. But over time and rapidly, really, the evidence is growing that some types of mobile health interventions are most effective. We've just actually done a review of more than 100 studies of this and published it a few weeks ago, specifically regarding tobacco use. But that's just one example. I'll talk about that. So, and tobacco use is strongly associated with adversity. Mm-hmm. But essentially what we found is that most e-health and m-health efforts were not effective. But those that had a combination. It's not enough to just have websites with information. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to just have an advice line where, you know, children will call a number. Now, they are great. They're essential, but it's not enough. Mm-hmm. That there needs to be follow-up and that needs to be individualised. That the child, through WhatsApp or whatever means, through Facebook, whatever the means they choose to communicate, that there's individualised response in addition to providing other, you know, like lots of information on, you know, mobile apps and so on. But it only tends to be successful if there's individualised follow-up. That's resource intensive.
Mm.
That really takes a lot in society investment, because you need staff for that who really understand young people. Now, that's happening. There are many non-government, also government groups around the world that are doing that. And there's a new generation of young people, young counsellors and so on, who are very familiar with the virtual world, and they really know how to connect.
Right.
And so there's a positive future. There will be meaningful supports available for children, as unfortunately, you know, of course, they're becoming less accessible through physical space.
But what I'm getting from this is that just because children are on a digital platform, it doesn't mean that the information or the support given to them on these platforms is distant. You know, at the end of the day, they want to hear somebody else engaging with them,
yes.
Somebody whom they can trust. They feel they can trust.
Yeah. They have to feel that someone cares. You know, mm-hmm. that seems completely obvious.
And
when
regardless
I say that,
of whether it's a public in school, regardless of whether it's in a clinic or it's on their phones, they still want to have that connection.
A lot of people are very familiar with this in their own life. They remember one teacher who was special,
yes.
And that one teacher could affect the course of their life.
Mm.
And even if you had a very adverse experiences in difficult environments as a child, if you had one teacher who was sort of a lifeline, and so many people will talk about that. Now, that can be the case with an online counsellor.
Absolutely.
And what I should also say, what seems not to be effective is where there's a service where, yes, there might be individualised sort of advice given, text messaging and so on, but it's the consistency of the provider.
Absolutely.
That a relationship needs to be formed.
Mm.
And it's that connection with a caring adult relationship, which is non-judgmental, seems to be vital.
Just very quickly to wrap up, Professor Michael, if you could share your work with Malaysia, particularly with University of Malaya, in looking at adverse childhood experiences and studying this kind of long-term impact.
It's been my great pleasure over many years to be connected with the Department of Social and Preventive Medicine at University of Malaya. More than 12 years ago, we did it was really the first randomised study of child maltreatment in schools. It was in Selangor. We interviewed about 1,400 young people, and so we were able to, you know, generate some evidence about physical abuse and sexual abuse and emotional abuse of children. And that was really, and that work has spawned further work. We're excited at the moment about new prospects where we have a cohort of adults and particularly many older adults who've been connected with a research project, a health research project, and we'll be going back to them and looking at the lifelong impacts of childhood adversity within the Malaysian population. We don't want to discover obvious things. We don't want to show that abused children are more likely to have, you know, mood disorders. And, you know, we're not about discovering, about just revisiting. We have an opportunity here in Malaysia, and my colleagues at UM are very excited about it. We have an opportunity because it's such a strong data set that so many people have given of their time over years, that we know a lot about their health, and they're also quite cooperative. And we can learn something here about the impact of childhood adversity on the stability of a person's health across their later adult years, including whether they have continuing persistent depression over a 10-year period, whether they have chronic physical conditions that persist over a long period, and to what extent that may be related to childhood adversity. And I think it could be powerful new information that is rare internationally.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll be keeping our eye on that one.
That's right. We want to learn something new and
yes.
something that's
going to... And what we can put in place
to break
up that cycle.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think the cycle of violence has been well studied recently particularly in Indonesia and in Papua New Guinea and in Sri Lanka. And there's some fascinating work published in The Lancet that shows that, yes, there's a cycle of violence, but there are some conditions some social conditions and factors that might explain why, for some families, it doesn't continue. So I think that there's a lot that we are learning from research in this region.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Michael. I've been speaking to Professor Michael Dunn, Professor of Social Epidemiology from the Queensland University of Technology in Australia, about the long-term effects of childhood adversity. You're listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.